I'm having to tiptoe through scores of graves. There's no signpost to say this way to Malcolm X. So I've no way of knowing where Malcolm is buried, so I'm going to have to ask some of these guys who work in the graveyards. Excuse me. I'm trying to find where Malcolm is buried.
You've been heading in the right direction, over on that, in the curve there.
Just where I was?
Towards the front there, over this way.
Right across from that garbage can.
Near that dogwood tree.
Thanks. If I'm going in the wrong direction, shout.
Okay.
Okay.
I heard shots, and I saw people crawling on the floor.
I couldn't have cried anymore, I don't believe. If I had lost my mother.
He's a regular man.
Malcolm will scare you to death.
Can I first of all clear up your name? Was it in fact Malcolm Bickle?
I don't think it was in fact. If it was in fact, I would have let it remain. Little was the name of the man who formerly owned my grandfather as a slave, so I gave it back.
So do people now address you as Mr. X?
Mr. X, Malcolm X.
Dr. King belongs to the entire world, but Malcolm X belongs to us.
But I thought Malcolm X belonged to me. As a teenager, the autobiography of Malcolm X was never far away from me. Although he was an African-American, Malcolm's life felt relevant to me growing up black in Britain. Malcolm made me think. He made everybody think, whether he wanted to or not. Malcolm's short life ended when he was only 39 years old. He was assassinated in New York City on February the 21st, 1965. But 3 years ago, the tranquility that death brought to Malcolm's turbulent life was rudely disturbed. I'm in New York to find out for myself just what happened. Here's the garbage can, they said. Just go in. Johnson. Westcott. Oh. The only grave here with flowers. It says Hajj Malik El Shabazz. Ferncliff Cemetery, about a 40-minute train ride north of Manhattan. Apart from the grave diggers, I was the only person there that morning. It was a moment I'd thought about for years, to be able to greet Al-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, born Malcolm Little, but better known as Malcolm X. His wife, Dr. Betty Shabazz, is buried in the same plot. Malcolm X was scary, and clever, and stylish, and complicated. He was the most controversial of the African-American leaders. He caused a furore when he described Kennedy's assassination as chickens coming home to roost. They called him the angriest man in America. But by 1999, even the establishment view of him had changed, and he was lauded with the accolade of his own US postage stamp. But in March 2002, word got out that the world was about to lose the vast archive of this enigmatic American icon.
I was actually sitting at my desk in my office here at the center, and a friend of mine who's a Malcolm X aficionado called me and asked me if I had my computer turned on. I said, yeah. He said, well, you need to go to eBay. I've seen some stuff up there, but I need to check to see if it's real. We started looking at the individual items that were there, and to the best of my knowledge, they looked as real as was possible. And his question was, he had two questions. He said, how did it get there, A? And then the second question is, what are you going to do about it?
So Howard Dodson, the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, found the personal effects of Malcolm X, his letters, speeches, diaries, his copy of the Quran, for sale on an internet auction site. The crude selling off of Malcolm X in lots to the highest bidders was about to begin. Many people feared Malcolm X, but someone who was very close to Malcolm and understood him in all his complexities was the actor and writer Ozzie Davis.
So
this was the exact date of that funeral was when? February the 27th?
It was February.
Ossie Davis 20. Watched the charismatic young man evolve from the racial separatism of the Nation of Islam to mainstream Islam. 28th? I went to see Ossie Davis at his home to talk to him about the Malcolm he knew, and he read the eulogy he wrote for his friend 40 years ago.
Oh, here it is. February 27, 1965. All right. Here, at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes.
Extinguished now and gone from us forever. For Harlem is where he worked and where he struggled and fought. His home of homes, where his heart was and where his people are.
One of the daughters moved to Florida. And without knowledge of the other sisters, packed up the material that was stored in the family home and shipped it with her own effects to Florida. She apparently, when she got to Florida, put a significant amount of this material in one of the storage warehouses, you know, like storage locker, and left it there.
Now, that storage facility requires that you pay rent. She failed to do that. As a consequence of that, they were auctioned off.
Joseph Fleming is the Shabazz family lawyer.
And they were auctioned off. They were actually purchased by a street vendor. He purchased the entire lot, which is everything within the storage facility. And when he found what he had, he did not truly understand its value. So he actually began to sell them in a flea market, one little piece at a time, until somehow it was brought to his attention that he had something of great monetary and historical value in his possession. So he gathered it all up and he took it to an auction house in Florida. That auction house realized immediately what it had, and it consigned it to another auction house, Butterfield's, which is connected with eBay in California. And that's how the material made its journey from the storage bin to a flea market to an auction house in Florida to an auction house in California.
Many will ask what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain. And we will smile.
Malcolm X had the rare gift of packing a punch whilst provoking laughter. Put simply, he was funny too.
Back during slavery, there was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. The house Negro, if the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick? We sick." On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night, and he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro.
Certainly during the 60s, the public press consistently represented Malcolm as a purveyor of violence. And he never was. He certainly was a relentless and ruthless critic of American society and its hypocrisy. But he was equally ruthless in his criticism of the African-American community, especially its leadership. Few, if any, prior to him had the courage to do that. looking people dead in the eye and saying, you hypocrite. And Malcolm would just be right there looking you dead in the eye and saying, come on, fess up. This is the real deal. Now what you going to do?
I arranged to meet the third of Malcolm X's six daughters, Ilyasa Shabazz, to talk with her about her father and the loss and recovery of his archive. Ilyasa's tall and elegant, just like her father, and when she smiles, she looks just like him too. As a two-year-old, Ilyasa was sitting in the audience with her mother and two older sisters when her father was murdered. 40 years on, she was keen to meet me at a place that I thought would hold too many painful memories for her.
We're at the Audubon Ballroom, where my father was assassinated in 1965, February 21st, 1965. And look at the ceilings. We still have some of the original structure, the marble,
It's very ornate.
Yes,
beautiful.
Right. It's a memorial site. The Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Cultural and Educational Center.
Quite a few people I've spoken to have said that when they think back to Malcolm, listening to his speeches, seeing him deliver speeches, the thing that it engendered in them was fear. And I'm wondering if you know why they would say that.
He was angry. You have 22 million black people in America. Not even talking about the black people in your country, or the black people in South America, or, you know, all around the world, the African diaspora. But you have 22 million people in America, and when you think about what their great-great-grandparents had to endure from morning till night, you would be damn mad. And it's funny when people say that he's angry, but yet they ignore the history
that produced that anger.
Right. They ignore it.
I'm a Muslim. I believe in the religion of Islam. I believe in Allah. I believe in Muhammad. I believe in all of the prophets. But at the same time that I believe in that religion, I have to point out I'm also an American Negro. And I live in a society whose social system is based upon the castration of the black man, whose political system is based on castration of the black man, and whose economy is based upon the castration of the black man. A society which in 1964 has more subtle, deceptive, deceitful methods to make the rest of the world think that it's cleaning up its house, while at the same time the same things are happening to us in 1964 that happened in 1954, 1924, and in 1884. They came up with what they call a civil rights bill in 1964, supposedly to solve our problem, and after the bill was signed, three civil rights workers were murdered in cold blood. And the FBI head, Hoover, admits that they know who did it. They've known ever since it happened, and they've done nothing about it. So my contention is that whenever a people come to the conclusion that the government which they have supported proves itself unwilling and or proves itself unable to protect our lives and protect our property because we have the wrong color skin, we are not human beings unless we ourselves band together and do whatever, however, whenever is necessary to see that our lives and our property is protected. And I doubt that any person in here would refuse to do the same thing were he in the same position, or I should say, were he in the same condition.
If some action was not taken to forestall that sale, this material would be basically thrown to the wind.
Howard Dodson's struggle to save the archive was supported throughout by lawyer Joseph Fleming.
We're not just talking about a few sheets of paper. We're talking about decades of photographs and letters and journals and documents of all types. We're talking about the thoughts and written images from Malcolm's mind that no one has ever seen before. But these are the types of things that we were able to recover. These are things that are now deposited with the Schomburg.
Presumably money played a part in appeasing all the parties.
That's true. The money always talks. I mean, when there's a gap in communication, you drop a dollar bill in there and all of a sudden everyone speaks the same language. So yes, money was a factor.
how much?
The details we can't discuss.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
You well?
How are you? Okay. Yeah, it's right there.
The next day, Ilyasa met me at the Schomburg Center in Harlem. This was a chance for her to take a close look at her father's recovered archive. As we were being ushered into a small conference room, Ilyasa became subdued. The archivist carries in what looks like an in-tray, and in it are a few books and a small pile of handwritten letters. I discovered that this was the first time that Ilyasa had set eyes on some of her father's most personal possessions.
This is his phone.
It was the maroon, leather-bound copy of her father's Quran that seemed to leave Ilyasa virtually speechless.
Okay. I don't know what good I'm going to be now. Is there something that you want to ask me?
Another man to set you free, you will never be free. Freedom is something that you have to do for yourselves. And until the American Negro lets the white man know that we are really, really ready and willing to pay the price that is necessary for freedom, our people will always be walking around here second-class citizens, or what you call 20th century slaves.
What price are you talking about, sir?
The price of freedom is death.
And this is one of his diaries. Right. And diary, not in the sense of what I did today, but, well, actually, this is his diary when he made his Hajj.
So this is clearly your father as a Sunni Orthodox Muslim.
Right. Around whites for first time in my life. That was the first time he had absolutely no conscience of his ethnicity. The whites don't seem white. Islam actually removed differences. I felt alone, lonely. Oh. You know, my father was, you know, mush. Wow, this is really amazing. This is a regular man. Absolutely. I turned my car in the other day for another black one, just like Brother Curtis' three X's, but a four-door. You will like it when you see it, and maybe I'll relent, go out of my mind, and let you drive it. Smile. I guess you know that would really be the day. What a lovely letter. I didn't understand what you were trying to tell me on the phone yesterday, so you'll have to take time to put it in a letter. The main thing I want you to do is be happy and to enjoy yourself. You will stay young and beautiful longer that way. Keep me posted. How beautiful is that? Most women would absolutely want their husbands to write them a letter like this.
Read on, I'm taking notes.
Keep me posted on how you're fixed for money. I don't want you to be out there broke, and at the same time, I don't want you to break me. Smile! I don't know if I'll be out there this weekend, maybe Friday or Saturday, or whether it will be early part of next week, whatever our holy apostle says. Kiss Attila for me and have Attila kiss you for me in return. Give the greetings to all the believers. Make friends with everyone. Speak ill of no one and find fault with no one. Thank Allah for our many, many blessings. Assalamu alaikum, your tired husband, Malcolm X. My gosh. You know, and after seeing all this, you just fall in love with this man. You fall in love with him.
Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. This was his meaning to his people.
Oh, how do you like that?
Walking through the library, Ilyasa was introduced to a significant figure from her father's past.
Oh, yeah. That's you?
This was Abdul Razak, an athletic-looking, elderly African-American man with white hair and a white beard, wearing, on closer inspection, a white hospital uniform. For the last year of Malcolm X's life, he'd been his personal secretary. It was during these months that Malcolm had split from the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, He'd also travelled extensively throughout Africa and the Middle East, and had even revised his thinking on working closer with other civil rights leaders, like Dr. Martin Luther King.
Down, your father was sitting next to me. Dr. King had a...
How do you like that?
Press conference. And your father said, I'd really like to shake his hand. And I said, come on. And I grabbed his hand and ran. Actually, they tried to stop me from getting to Dr. King. A guy tried to block me. And I maneuvered him and put the hands together and then ran around.
In 1963, Malcolm X ended his long association with the Nation of Islam when he discovered that his leader and so-called prophet, Elijah Muhammad, was secretly fathering illegitimate children. Malcolm rejected requests to keep these revelations quiet. He then set up his own organisation. It appeared that Malcolm had provided his enemies with the ammunition they were looking for. Support from staunch friends and followers like Abdul Razak was invaluable, but in the end, just wasn't enough to save him.
Of course, his execution was a tragedy, but we all knew he had to die. He knew it, and I knew it. And anyone close to him knew it. They had to kill him.
Were you there that day?
Yes, I was. I was there every...
Were you on the stage?
Yeah, I was on the stage, the backstage. You, your mother, and everybody was sitting right here, facing it at right angles to the stage.
In the first third of the audience shouted, come out of my pocket, come out of my pocket. And I heard my husband say, everything is all right, everything is all right. And someone seated in about the third row stood up, and I heard shots, and I saw people crawling on the floor. And so I got down too. But then when I was looking out, and I saw someone look in amazement to the front, I knew they had shot my husband.
Standing at the graveside, looking at that date, February the 21st, 1965. It's easy to forget that when Malcolm X was shot, he was only a few months away from his 40th birthday. He was a young man, an angry young man. But looking through some of the recovered archive reminded me, of course, that there was far more to Malcolm beyond anger and rage. At the time of his death, he was embracing both mainstream Islam and black nationalism. He was evolving, still changing. The wrangling over possession of his legacy could be seen as a way of owning him. But in some ways it's also a metaphor for the man. No one could own him, because he was a seeker. A man who strove for new ways of seeing, always with the objective to improve.
That was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is.
And is.
A prince.
A prince.
Our black shining prince.
Black shining prince.
Who didn't hesitate to die.
Who didn't hesitate to die.
Because he loved us.
Because he loved us so. That's what I had the chance to say to Malcolm, for Malcolm. And the archive will go a long way toward helping America see more clearly not only who Malcolm was, but to see its own involvement in his life and in his death. He was, in my opinion, as much a revolutionary as Thomas Jefferson. And I often say that if Thomas Jefferson and his cohorts had the benefit of the kind of nomenclature that Malcolm had, he would have been called Thomas X.
I wonder if there was any one occasion with Malcolm when, once he'd broken with the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, was there one moment where you actually saw that change?
Yes. However, let's begin by saying it was not a moment when I was able to patronize Malcolm and look and say, now you're meeting my standards because you've changed. No, no, no. we all were involved with him at a deeper, more emotional, more personal level. And it was in this very room where you and I are sitting right now. And Malcolm had come to visit Ruby and me, and he came by himself. And he came in the room, and he sat with his back to that wall, because even then there were people out to kill him. So he was always in a defensive posture. And he had just come to talk. He didn't want advice. He didn't want support. I think he just wanted to just talk. And he sat there, and he talked, and he explained to us the changes in his life, what it had meant when he was in prison and first got word about Elijah Muhammad, and how Elijah's influence reached down into that prison and began to change him, and what Elijah Muhammad meant to him as a father, as a prophet, as God. And then the heartbreak of a son who finds that the father he loved has feet of clay, and that the God he worshipped was not a God at all. This long, lanky man sitting right where that box is now, just slowly talking, slowly explaining it, finding it out for himself, sharing his pain, his hurt, his wisdom, his understanding. But to sit there and listen and be touched, just the memory of it now still moves me deeply. And it was then that I knew the depth of this man's soul. Oh, yeah. Still miss that man.